Quentin hung limply from the wagon wheel, his mind benumbed with a pain drumming through every extremity of his broken body. He was unaware that he was making any sound at all, unaware of anything but the throbbing, insistent agony. All day long, the wheel had spun over rock and root, through dust and deep water, and Quentin, lashed to the wheel, had been slowly tortured into insensibility. He did not notice when the wheel finally stopped, nor when the sun set, nor when night brought an end to his torture. He hung on the wheel as darkness deepened around him. Amidst the ordered confusion of Nin's army making camp for the night, the moon rose fair and full, and with it, the wolf star. Quentin gazed unblinking at the moon with unseeing eyes. Some small part of his mind watched it curiously, a frightened animal peering out from the cave where it had retreated to escape the hunters. After a long time, it seemed to Quentin that the moon was coming toward him, leaving its course in the black dome of heaven to swim closer and closer. He could see it weaving over him, shining with a gentle light. It had two dark eyes that watched strangely. He wanted to reach out and place his hand against its smooth, luminous surface, but his hands would not obey. Then, the moon disappeared. Years passed, or were they moments? Quentin next felt something cool touch his forehead. He opened his eyes and saw that the moon had come back. It was looking at him. He struggled to lift his head to speak, but lacked the strength, so simply allowed the moon to comfort him with its cool touch.
Kenta, can you hear me? It is Toli. Kenta.
Quentin blinked his eyes and peered dully back at the round, shining face of the moon. He opened his mouth to speak, but could not remember how to form the words.
Do not try to speak. Just listen to me. I have come to free you, Kenta. Can you hear me?
Why was this moon so persistent? What did it want? Quentin wanted only to drift back into the soothing void of unconsciousness.
Here is some water.
Quentin felt something press against his lips, and cool liquid spilt gently into his mouth.
Drink it slowly.
Next, Quentin felt something tugging at his hand. He felt it, though it seemed to him that his hand was far away, and no longer a part of him. When the hand was free, it fell limp and useless, to dangle at his side. Quentin watched as the moon stooped to slice through the cords which bound his feet. Then the other hand swung free, and he pitched forward onto his knees and into the solid arms of the moon.
Can you move?
Quentin made no answer. He felt himself rolled to the ground gently, and then half lifted, half dragged, under the shelter of the wagon. Toli fell to rubbing some life back into his friend's mangled limbs. Quentin sank once more into peaceful oblivion.
Kenta, wake up. It is time to go.
Toli.
Shh. I am here. Thank the God you are alive. I thought I'd lost you.
What has happened? Oh.
Quentin's shoulder had begun throbbing again, and the pain and the night chill revived him somewhat.
Where am I?
There is no time, Kenta. It will be morning soon. We must get away now. Can you move?
I do not know. I don't think so.
You must try. Here, come. I will help you.
Toli gently lifted his master to a sitting position, but even this effort caused black waves of dizziness to wash over Quentin.
I think your right arm is broken, Kenta. Hold it close to your side and try not to move it.
I cannot feel anything. But my shoulder...
Toli had placed his hands under Quentin's arm to drag him from beneath the wagon.
The soldiers are asleep, but there are sentries around the perimeter. They are careless, for they are not expecting an encounter this night. We have a chance. Can you stand?
With Toli's help, Quentin struggled to his feet, then swayed uncertainly. The pain took his breath away.
I will hold you, but we must move now.
Toli guided his first fettering steps as Quentin stumbled helplessly forward, trying to make his legs move in harmony. It was no use. He collapsed, not two steps from where they had started.
Here, good. We try again. Lean on me.
Tully raised Quentin back to his feet, and they started off again. Quentin tried to raise his head, but searing fireballs of pain burned through his brain at the effort. He let his head wobble upon his chest as Tully propelled them forward. The earth felt queer beneath his feet, as if it were rolling away from him with every step. His legs kept entangling themselves and tripping him, but somehow Tully kept them both upright and moving.
Ahead is a gully maybe 50 paces. We will be hidden there. We can rest before moving again, but we must be as far away from here as possible before daylight.
They lurched through the darkness as Tully's Nighthawk vision kept watch for signs of discovery. They were moving away from camp. The wagon stood between them and the huddled masses of sleeping enemy soldiers. But ahead lay the circle of sentries at their posts. The gully, little more than a weedy depression carved in the ground, opened before them. And when they reached it, Quentin slid down the side to lay on his back. His head ached, and dark shapes like the wings of ravens swarmed before his eyes. Tully crawled to the rim of the gully to look back toward the wagons.
I think they may have discovered our escape. Someone is moving around the wagon. We must move on quickly.
Tully lifted Quentin to his feet, and crouching as low as could be managed, they staggered off again. Quentin concentrated on putting one foot in front of the other and staying upright. Tully bore the responsibility for keeping them moving. It was all Quentin could do not to cry out with pain when his shoulder was jostled.
There are trees up ahead. If we can reach them, perhaps we can rest again.
Arbas!
They know!
Somehow they reached the trees. Tully propped Quentin up beside a formless trunk and left him there holding his arm with his good hand. Though the night was cool, Quentin swam in his own sweat and tasted its salty tang on his lips. He fought to remain conscious when he saw the black wings fluttering closer. Tully was back beside him in an instant.
They are looking for us. They know you have escaped. They have not yet turned toward the trees, but it is only a matter of time. They will find the gully, and they will follow it as we have. We cannot stop here.
Quentin nodded. With Tully beside him, he started off again, blindly. Between the sweat running in his eyes and the darkness of the wood, he could see nothing. There were torches wavering over the landscape now. The soldiers were searching for them in knots of three or more, spreading out over the land. Once Quentin thought he saw the flare of a torch off to his right, moving even with them.
I have a horse waiting, down there.
Quentin realized dimly that they were standing at the top of a low bluff whose slope was clothed in brambles. Before he could speak, Tully had been plunging down the slope and into the thickets, heedless of the barbs tearing at their flesh. Quentin fought his way through, and with Tully ever at his side, had almost reached the bottom when his foot struck against a root and he was flung headlong down the slope. He landed hard, unable to break his fall with his hands, and he felt something give way in his injured shoulder. Then he felt Tully's strong hands jerking him once more to his feet. He was pushed into the saddle to hang like a sack of barley, his head on one side and feet on the other. Tully was instantly behind him, holding him on with one hand and snapping the reins with the other. He saw a light, and then another. A dark shape rushed at them from out of the brush. Tully slashed down at it with the reins. Suddenly, the copse was ablaze with torches. Tully jerked the reins hard and turned the horse toward the slope, but it was too steep for the frightened animal. Quentin was flung to the ground, and Tully on top of him. In an instant, they were ringed in by soldiers and seized. Quentin felt the last fine threads of strength and will leave him, and he knew no more. The candles burned low in their tall holders. Several had sputtered out, and the inner chamber of the elders smelled of hot beeswax and tallow. The elders sat stone-like, each one hunched over, head bowed and hands clasped. All was silent. The night had drawn full measure, and still they sat, waiting, listening, searching within themselves for an answer to Yesef's dream. A most disturbing dream. Then, at last, the waiting was over, for Clamor raised his hands.
Peram nimpanrai rigel des onus vistoren,
Intona blessori amatil curdes Joel Belforas, King of Kings, whose name is most high, your servant praises your name forever.
The three others slowly raised their heads and looked at Clamor. His eyes were closed, and his hands raised to either side of his face.
Speak, Elder Clamor, tell us what has been revealed to you.
The river is truth, and the water peace. And the river runs through the land, giving life to all who seek it. For truth is life. But the storm of war descends, and its evil defiles the water. Truth is poisoned by the lie and is choked off. When truth perishes and peace dries up, the land dies. And the gales of war blow over the land, filling the sky with clouds of death, which is the dust. Then darkness, evil, covers all, blotting out the light of good. The child who cries out in the darkness is a child of the light who has lost his father, the ways of righteousness. His father's sword is the knowledge of the truth, which has been destroyed. But there are some left who do not go down to death and darkness, who still remember the river and the water and the living land. They are the man who weeps. The tears are the prayers of the holy who mourn the coming of evil. The prayers are poured out and become a sword of light, which is faith. The sword flashes against the darkness of evil because it is alive, the spirit of the Most High. The sword is to be given to the child. But alas, the child has been overcome by the night and is carried off.
Brothers, we must not forget that dreams may have several meanings and all of them true. I do not doubt that the interpretation we have just heard is truly of the Most High, but I am troubled by one thing.
What is that?
Jolin opened his hand toward Yesif, inviting him to speak freely.
It was your dream, after all.
I feel as if there were some more present danger yet unspoken.
Certainly the dream is dire enough, Yesif.
And its interpretation is clear warning.
Yes, a warning of something to come, but also a reflection of something even now taking place.
Well said, Yesif. I think so too. The interpretation was given us that we might be ready for what is to come. The dream was given to us that we might know there is peril even now upon us.
Clamor nodded gravely, and Pater pulled on his gray beard.
What does your heart tell you, Yesif? What are we to do?
I hardly know, Pater, but I feel a great torment in my spirit. It has grown through the night as we have sat here. I feel that we must, even now, pray for the Child of Light whom we have sent out from among us.
Who is that, Yesif?
Quintin.
Quintin? But he is an Ascalon.
Quintin, yes. And Toli, too. They are in desperate need. I feel it.
Then it may be that our prayers are needed at this moment if the dream is to have an ending.
Jolin turned to the others.
I too am troubled about Yesif's dream. It does not suggest an end, which means that the end is still in doubt. Therefore, we must unite our spirits and those of our people to bring about the ending which the Most High will show us.
Your thoughts are mine.
Then let us not waste another moment. Our prayers must begin at once.
Jolin raised his hands and closed his eyes. The others followed his example. Outside the temple, the silvery light of dawn was tinting the gray curtain of night in the east. Dawn brought with it a sullen chill. The horizon showed an angry red, dull and brooding, though the sky seemed clear enough overhead. The wind had changed with the coming of morning. Toli had noted it as he lay bound beside his master. Quentin hardly breathed at all. He clung to life with a tenuous grasp. Several times before dawn, Toli had had to place his ear against Quentin's chest to see if he still lived. In the camp, the soldiers were busy making ready for their day's march. Toli, whose eyes missed nothing, had a presentiment that he and Quentin would not be making the trip with them, for he had seen a group of soldiers readying ropes and harness, and the three guards who now stood over them pointed at them. Tully knew that the means of their execution was being prepared. The cooking fire sent white smoke drifting through the camp. The guard was changed on the prisoner so those who had watched through the night could be fed. When all the soldiers had eaten and were ready to march, reckoned Tully, they would be assembled to view the execution as an entertainment, something to dwell on as they marched that day. Tully spent his last moments of life praying for his master, who could not pray for himself. Tully was roused by a sharp kick to his back. The blow rolled him over, and Tully looked up into the hate-filled face of a giant who held a battle axe with a head blade as wide as a man's waist. The giant, whose face was seamed with crisscrossing scars, pointed at the captives. The guard seized them and dragged them out into the meadow where the army had camped, pushing through the mass of thronging soldiers who formed a solid wall around some object which held their attention. Tully and Quentin were pushed through the assembled host and thrown down at the edge of a wide ring formed by the shields of the soldiers. In the center of the ring stood two horses, one facing east and the other west. Between the horses lay a tangle of ropes and two heavy, yoke-like objects. At the farther side of the ring stood the warlord's black steed, tossing his head and jerking the arm of the soldier holding his bridle. As Tully watched, a ripple coursed through the ranks at the edge of the ring, and a wide avenue opened, through which came a man wearing a breastplate of bronze and a helmet of bronze which had two great plumes like wings affixed to its crest. A cloak was clasped at one shoulder, beneath which protruded the thin blade of his cruelly curved sword. Tully had no doubt that he was seeing the warlord.
Stay asleep, Kenta, and fear nothing. I will go before you.
But it was not to be. His eyelids flickered, and he turned cloudy eyes upon Tully, who now knelt over him.
My friend, I am sorry.
Quentin seemed to know what was about to happen. Both prisoners were jerked to their feet. Quentin was made to stand, supported between two scowling soldiers, one of whom grasped a handful of hair in order to keep the captive's head erect. The warlord gave a second signal, and there was a sudden scuffle behind the two captives. A third prisoner was flung forward into the ring. He was a soldier, bound head and foot as Quentin and Tully were.
One of the sentries of last night.
Sweat soaked his hair and ran down his face, a hideous mass of ugly purple welts, for the man had already received a sound beating. The luckless trooper was quickly wrenched to his feet by two other guards, who then stripped him naked. The unfortunate was marched to the center of the ring, where the giant with the broad axe waited between the two horses. He was pushed down to the ground as his arms and legs were securely tied to the heavy wooden yokes. Then, upon signal, the two horses harnessed to the yokes were led slowly away in opposite directions. The ropes pulled taut. The giant stepped into place over his prey. The victim was lifted off the ground to hang in agony while his body stretched by slow degrees. The horses leaned into their harnesses. The giant, quick as lightning, spun the broad axe in a flashing circle about his head and with one hand brought the blade down with a mighty stroke. The poor wretch was hewn neatly in half. Tully glanced fearfully at Quentin, who stared emptily at the horrible spectacle. Though his master's eyes were open, Tully couldn't tell if they saw what had been played out before them. His look was vague and far away. The warlord led his steed across the ring to where Tully and Quentin waited. Tully gritted his teeth and stared stubbornly ahead. The warlord glared down at his prisoners for a moment. Tully raised his eyes, snapping with defiance, and for a brief instant, their gazes met. Blood spurted from a gash over Tully's eye and ran down his face. The warlord shot a quick glance at Quentin, who still seemed not to know what was happening around him. Then the warrior chief swung his mount around and trotted back to the center of the ring. He looked slowly around the entire circle of faces in his army. From the somber mood which suddenly fell upon the host, Tully guessed that the speech was an order of an official reprimand. The warlord nodded and soldiers began readjusting the yokes and harness. Tolly believed the moment to be his last. He closed his eyes.
Winnowak, give me the strength to die with dignity.
Tolly opened his eyes to the far hills and trees, intent that his last memory should not be of his executioner or the grotesque corpse lying in two pieces beside the wicked blade. He felt a twinge of regret that he would not be able to comfort his master in his last moment, nor even say his leave as a man would. But he doubted whether Quentin would know or understand anyway. The soldiers on either side of him tightened their grasp, and suddenly he was being dragged forward. His heart raced madly in his chest, and his vision suddenly became remarkably acute. He saw every blade of grass under his feet, and every leaf on every branch of nearby trees stood out in breathtaking clarity. He was conscious of the air as it filled his lungs, the taste of it, the tingling freshness as it rushed in. He felt the sun on his neck, and thought that if he tried, he could count each single ray as it touched him. How strange that every nerve and fiber of his being should be so fully alive this close to death. Then he was struck with a horrible thought. In this heightened state, he would be able to see the executioner's blade as it glittered in the air in its lazy arc. He would be able to feel each tiny fiber of muscle stretch and pull. He would feel his bones wrenched leisurely from their sockets. He would hear his own spine snap. He would see in that most hideous of moments, stretched out far, far beyond its normal length, the cruel blade bite deep into his flesh, cleaving bone from muscle. And he would see himself severed in half, and feel the awful rush of his organs spilling out. He would know his death in its most terrifying aspect. He would die not instantly, as it would seem to those who looked on. He would die with torturous slowness, gradually, bit by excruciating bit.
You look better this morning than you have in weeks, sire.
Derwin had seen the king from across the garden and had watched him for some moments before approaching. Escavar sat quietly on a small stone bench amidst a riotous splash of color from the flowers of every shade and description. A shadow vanished from the king's brow as he looked up and saw his physician coming toward him.
Thanks to the ministrations of my good hermit, I think I will yet trouble this world with my existence.
Derwin cocked a wary eye at Escavar.
How strangely you put it. Sire, I would have thought that today, of all days, you would rejoice in your improved health and put gloomy thoughts far behind you.
Then little you know me, sir. I may not make merry when men of my bidding are still abroad.
It is midsummer!
Derwin's gaiety was a little forced. He too felt uneasy about Quentin and Tolly and the others being so long away.
I would not wonder if they were enjoying the hospitality of one of the happy villages by the sea.
You contrive to cheer me, but your words fall far short of the mark, Derwin, though I thank you for the attempt. I know too well that something is wrong in Mensendor. Something is very wrong.
Derwin stepped closer to his monarch and laid a hand on his shoulder. The king looked up into the hermit's eyes and smiled wanly.
Sire, I too feel a dread creeping over the land. Sometimes my heart flutters unexpectedly, or a chill falls upon me as I sit in my chamber before the fire, and I know something is loose in the land that does not love peace. Too soon, I fear, we will face a most loathsome enemy. But I also know that we stand in the light of the god's pleasure, and no darkness can extinguish it.
I wish I had faith enough to believe in your god. I have seen too much of religion to believe.
Escavar rose slowly to his feet. Derwin reached out a hand and steadied him. The two old friends walked the garden paths side by side in silence for a long time. Derwin kept his hand under the king's arm.
I do not think I could survive another campaign. Another war.
You are tired, sire. That is all. You have been very ill. Take your time and do not let such thoughts trouble you. When you have regained your strength, you will feel differently, I assure you.
Perhaps.
The sun shone down in a friendly way, and all the gardens seemed to shout with the exuberance of life. A fountain splashed in a shady nook near a wall covered with white morning glories. The king's daughter stood by that fountain. Knowing the young girl's positive effect on the man, Derwin turned aside and directed their steps toward the fountain, and the young woman dressed all in white samite, glistening like a living ray of light.
Ah, but the beauty of this wonderful place is dimmed when compared with that of your own, my lady. I bid thee good morning.
Bria, her hands busily plaiting a garland of ivy into which morning glories were woven, raised her head and smiled. Escavar seemed suddenly to become young once again, remembering perhaps another whose laughter enchanted him.
Come, father, and Derwin too. Sit beside me, and tell me what you two have been talking about this morning.
Well, we will sit with you, but it is you who must tell us what occupies your thoughts.
They sat on stone benches near the fountain. Escavar settled next to his lovely daughter and did not take his eyes from her. Bria began to relate the trivial commonplaces of her day and her excitement at the approach of the evening's midsummer celebration. There was no hint in her voice of anything but the most joyful anticipation and delight. How very like her mother. How wise and good. Her heart must have been filled with thoughts of Quentin and consumed with longing for his presence in this happy time, yet she did not let on that she felt anything but the most perfect contentment and happiness. She was doing it for her father, Derwin knew. After a little while, Derwin slipped quietly away and left his patient for the moment in the hands of an even more skillful physician, one whose very presence was a healing balm. Arriving at the road, Esme had faced a hard decision. To the north lay Ascalon and her goal. To the south, danger and the likelihood of being captured again. But she guessed that any help which she might bring must come out of the south too. That was the way her protectors, Quentin and Tully, had been heading when they encountered her. That was the way their friends were expected to return. The choice had occupied her the greater part of the afternoon, ever since leaving the Oracle. And upon reaching the seaside track, she was no further decided in her mind. Very likely, Quentin and Tully were dead, and it was almost certain that their friends, whoever they were, had been ambushed and killed, as had her own bodyguards. It seemed a futile gesture to run away from Ascalon now. There was nothing to be gained by wandering further afield. And yet, the words of Orphe's daughter still whispered in her mind.
But this ye do, and this will be found. Your errand done, when two are unbound.
What else could those words mean but that Quentin and Tully, the two, were still alive, but would not remain so unless she went to free them? If she believed the prophecy at all, it would mean that her errand would only be accomplished in securing their release. Made no sense. So, against all reason, she had turned Riv to the south. As their shadow deepened and lengthened in the late afternoon, they set off in search of friends in a friendless land. A long night, fraught with lingering chills, had passed into a sullen morning in which an angry red sun glowered upon the horizon. Esme was up and shaking the leaves and dew from her cloak. The sound was thin and far away, but it was a sound she knew well, the sound of men-at-arms moving with some speed and purpose. She ducked away again into her leafy refuge and led Riv out and along a route parallel to the road. They descended into a small valley and rose again to the top of a little tree-lined knob. From there, Esme judged that she would have a clear view of the road below without fear of being seen. She waited. The resentful sun rose slowly, throwing off a sulky light. The air seemed dank and stale. The sky held the feel of a storm, though not a cloud was to be seen. Such days did often betoken ill, and Esme hoped that its end would not leave her with cause for regret. Into the stillness of the morning came once more the refrain she had heard before. Presently, she saw the ruddy glint of a blade or helm as it caught the sun for a brief instant. Then, jouncing into view below her, came two knights, three more following close behind. Though she watched them for a while as they jogged along, Esme knew at once that she had nothing to fear from these men. They were not of the destroying horde she had twice encountered, and from her secret perch, she could barely make out the blazon of One Knight's shield as it hung beside him on his horse's flank, the twisting red dragon of the Dragon King. When the company of knights had drawn even with her hiding place, Esme urged Riv out gingerly and hastened down to meet them in the road. The two foremost knights exchanged glances quickly. It was clear they did not know what to make of her, a young lady riding out of the hills alone.
I am Ronsard, Lord High Marshal of Mensendor. I'm at your service, my lady.
I am Esme.
I used to know an Esme, though she was but a slip of a girl and shy as a young deer.
It is a common name.
Who was this man? Esme was certain that she had seen him before.
Of course, you are right. This Esme I knew lived away in Elsendor and was never fond of horses, as I see you must be to ride as you do.
A secretive smile played at the edges of the knight's mouth. Was he laughing at her?
Elsendor is a realm of some size. Perhaps you would remember whose house it was wherein you saw the girl that bears my name?
Well, I remember it. Often it was that I found lodging there and hospitality of a most royal kind.
Ronsard looked from one to the other of them, curiously.
It is well that we have naught to do but pass the time wagging our tongues. Or perhaps there is some hidden jest which this dull head does not apprehend.
Sir, if it is a jest, it is not mine. I am on an errand of some importance concerning friends of yours, I think.
Then, my lady, I suggest you tell us forthwith what you require of us. We are charged with an errand of importance as well.
Now, good Ronsard. Be not so hasty with this young lady. For though she is but stranger to you, I think her father is not.
You know my father? Your words addle me, sir, but there is something about you which seemed not altogether unfamiliar.
Yes, if you think you know something, then out with it.
Cry well. It may be that I am indeed mistaken. Yes, certainly I am. For any of King Trowin's offspring would know one whom they called uncle.
The young lady's dark eyes opened wide in disbelief. Her head shook dubiously, wagging the sleek braid at the back of her head.
Phaedo?
What a meeting is this! It is not to be believed.
Believe it, Ronsard. Allow me to present Princess Esme of Elsendor. Far from home she may be, but far from friendless she is.
Phaedo! I do not believe it either, sir. Upon my word, he is the last man I would have expected to meet this day.
Well, might I say the same of you, Lady Esme. You see, Ronsard, I spent much time in the halls of King Trowin when the craven Jaspin seized my lands. I was made an outlaw in my own country. But Queen Besmere took me in, though her husband was away in the wars with Escobar.
However did you know me? I scarce but recognize you.
You have much of your mother's look about you, and much of your father's boldness. The name Esme is not so widely used as you would have us believe. When I saw you, I knew there could only be one. Join us, my lady, and tell us of your errand while we ride. We are for Ascalon, at once.
That suits me well.
I believe you spoke just now of friends of ours. What news would you bring us of them?
Dreadful news, sir. I wish it were not mine to tell. If you be friend to one called Quentin and his servant friend Tolly, then you must prepare for the worst.
Esme glanced fearfully at her two companions, their faces clouded with worry when she pronounced the names.
I see I am right.
You are. Tell us then what you know.
We were riding in search of you, my lords, traveling by night. We saw a fire, they said it was Ulam, burning, and we rode to give aid. We were met by a fierce enemy, and Quentin and Tolly were taken. I escaped.
I marvel at your fortune, and more at the directness of your speech.
My father has often said that bitter news does not grow sweeter on the tongue, and were better said quickly. If I thought that you would have been offended by my manner, I would have spared you.
Nay, spare us not, but tell us if we may hope for them.
Yesterday I thought not, but I chanced to meet an oracle by a pool. She gave me reason to hope and reason to try to find you.
An oracle, you say? Where need is great, any hand will serve, I guess. But we must not linger one moment longer. I fear my idle jesting has caused too much delay already. We will pick up the trail at Ulam. We will have to wait for the rest of your story, my lady. I do not wonder, but it is most remarkable.
We ride for Ulam!
Evening light lingered golden in the trees as Derwin stood out on the great bartizan overlooking the king's magnificent garden, now ablaze with 1,000 lanterns. Nervous young men escorted radiant young ladies along the garden paths. Fine lords and ladies in gay costume moved gracefully among blue and yellow striped pavilions. The midsummer celebration at Ascalon Castle was a feast for the senses, a thing of rare beauty.
Why so heavy-hearted, good Helm?
Derwin turned and bowed to his queen.
My lady, your eyes are as sharp as they are beautiful.
What can trouble your thoughts on an evening such as this? It is the night when all good things are dreamed. And you know that dreams may sometimes come true.
I wonder. Good does often seem so fragile against evil. The light so powerless against the darkness.
That is not the Derwin I know. You sound as if you have been taking the king's counsel.
Ah, so it is. How fickle a man's mind, ever prey to his emotions. A weathercock for whatever winds may blow. Yes. Yes, how silly I am. What good is a physician who does not take his own cure?
Alenia smoothly linked her arm in his and turned him toward the sweeping steps to the garden below.
Walk with me, kind friend, for I too have need of some good word.
A shadow moved across Alenia's lovely face. Derwin felt it like a pang.
If words can help, then rely on it that I will say them.
I have been troubled today myself. A subtle unease disquiets my inmost soul, and most elusive it is. No cause seems readily apparent. Often I discover myself to be thinking of Quentin.
I would calm you if I could, but these are not the words for it. I too have been thinking of Quentin this day, and of little else. When you came to me just now, I was thinking again of him, and of Tolly. Though even then I did not know it.
Do you think they may be in some trouble? It seems silly, I know.
Not at all, my lady, not at all. The Most High does often join our hearts with our loved ones in times of distress as well as joy. I have been praying for them all this day, though my prayers are uninformed.
I would that I had the knowledge of the Most High that you possess. Then I would not feel so disposed to the foolishness of a woman's fears.
But you have something which does serve as well. You have the ability to believe without the need for reasons or for great signs and wonders. Yours is a faith to endure.
And yours?
Mine will endure, but it is born of years of struggling and vain striving. I have come to my belief over a most circuitous and rocky path, and I cannot say which is the better. I think that God gives each soul what it requires, and there is the difference.
Still, I would know more of what you have learned in your quest. It cannot hurt to be informed.
Aye, my lady, you speak aright. I will gladly teach you what little I know. But do not be surprised if in your heart you already know the truth of what I would instruct. It is often thus.
They were silent as they reached the last step and entered the festive world of the Midsummer Revelers. Alenia turned and looked honestly into Derwin's broad and weathered face.
Let me come to you when the celebration is over. We will pray together. If one heart alone may have effect, then two will speed the remedy. And your sure prayers will guide my own more directly to the mark.
As you wish, my queen. I will await you.
They turned to see the king's pages, their long trumpets in hand, snap to attention. Then King Escobar himself was leaning on the stone balustrade, looking down upon the merrymaking.
My friends, I will not keep you long from your merrymaking, and I will join you soon. But I would tell you some things which have been on your king's heart of late. What I am about to tell you may cause you some concern. Please know that it is not my intention to worry you, nor cause you needless alarm.
What is he doing?
I do not know. He discussed nothing like this with me.
But as your king, I would be less than just if, knowing of danger to our realm, I did not at once warn my people to look to their safety. My heart can no longer abide rejoicing while across fair Menzendor the wild, angry clouds of war are gathering. Even now, my marshals scour the land to bring me word of our enemy, that we might know his strength and so arm against him. We shall fight for our land against any foe, and we shall win. Return now to your pleasure. It may be the last we will know for many dark days.
The king turned and walked away from the balustrade and disappeared into the castle.
What can he mean by this? Oh, Derwin, is he...
No. No. Do not be alarmed. He is as sane as you or I. Perhaps the more. I believe that his great heart feels more deeply for this land than any other person's. Somehow it is part of him. When it hurts, he hurts. I am certain that I am telling you nothing you do not already know.
That may be, but it is good to hear another say it. I have long known him to be unable to enter into gaiety when there is any unhappiness that he may cure. But he has never taken to this extreme.
Pray that I am wrong, my lady. But it may be that we will have cause ere long to look upon Escobar's ill-timed warning as the act of a most brave and noble soul. I think he senses something that is not yet apparent to us. I fear we will share his forebodings too soon.
You will excuse me, Derwin. I must hurry to attend him now. He will be wroth with himself for his outburst. He will want a cool hand to soothe his brow.
Derwin bowed, and the beautiful Alenia hurried away. He turned and saw that all eyes had been upon the queen in the moments following Escobar's strange address. Derwin smiled as broadly as he knew how and held up his hands.
Friends, let us enjoy our celebration. There may be trouble enough to come. So be it. But it is a good day, and we may have need of such joy ere long. So let us fill our hearts with happiness, and let care belong to the morrow.
In a short while, the garden was transformed into a scene of mirth and merriment. The ominous cloud, so sudden and unexpected in its appearance, had just as suddenly passed. Night came on, like a dream. Quentin had some vague recollection of a day that seemed to stretch out forever without end. He and Tolly had been thrown into the back of one of the wagons to wonder at their fate. There was not a heartbeat throughout the interminable day, but he did not relive the horror of their sunrise ordeal. He had been pulled across the execution ring at the signal of the warlord. Halfway to the bloody spot, he had seen the death man turn away. Quentin looked around as the warlord was riding through the scattering throng of his soldiers. The ring was melting away. Suddenly he understood that the warlord's order had been one of dismissal. The executions were over. For some reason, which he would not know until later, he and Tolly had been spared. Relief, however, was slow in coming as he watched the giant axeman walk away, rubbing the cruel head of his broadaxe with shreds of the dead man's clothes. Shortly after the wagon had begun to rumble and jostle away, Quentin had slumped into a deep sleep, broken only by Tolly's persistent nudging and admonitions to eat. They had by some chance been bundled into a wagon bearing provisions taken from Ulam. Tolly, after managing to loosen his bond somewhat, had gathered a little food for them. He was adamant that Quentin eat and regain some small part of his strength for whatever lay ahead. After a meal of dry grain, strong goat cheese, and hard bread, Quentin had fallen asleep again. It was nearly sunset on Midsummer's Day before he stirred.
You have decided to remain a little longer in this world.
They were now sitting amidst a careless jumble of food stores in the half-light of the covered wagon.
We have stopped.
Quentin struggled to sit up, but hot knives stabbed into his shoulder and arm. He ached all over.
Rest while you may, Kenta. Yes, we stopped some time ago. I think they are making camp for the night. Soon they will come for provisions.
What will happen to us then, I wonder?
Quentin shook his head as he looked across at his ever-resourceful servant.
I thought you were dead. You should have escaped while you could.
You know that was impossible. There could be no escape without my Kenta. It is unthinkable.
Well, we may both pay with our lives tomorrow. But I am glad you are here with me, Tolly. At least Esme escaped.
Yes.
Quentin felt as if he had touched an open wound.
I thought...
Is there much pain?
It comes and goes.
I feel as if my bones have been taken out, tumbled together and replaced one at a time, whichever came to hand.
I feared you dead when I saw you lashed to the wagon wheel, but you were displaying more wisdom and restraint than you usually do. I should have had us free and away from here, if not for that wretch of a guard.
His life was forfeit for his error.
Quentin paused, thinking again of the hideous spectacle he had witnessed, and only narrowly avoided taking part in.
Perhaps it was only meant to be a warning to us. Perhaps he did not intend to put us to death just yet, anyway.
What is important now is that we have time to try again to escape. Tonight will be an excellent opportunity.
Tonight?
Midsummer. They will occupy themselves with their revelry. The watch will be relaxed and inattentive. We may have a chance.
Quentin's head ached, remembering their previous attempt at escape. He seemed to remember something else about Midsummer, something which stirred a brief flutter of pleasure, but it faded even as he struggled to grasp it.
Midsummer? Do you think these barbarians mock such occasions?
There is a fair chance, I would say. Even the Jair observe the day of the long sun. It is so with most peoples. These would be no different.
Who are they? Why have they come to Mensendor?
Before they could ponder the question further, two soldiers appeared at the back of the wagon and pulled out the gate board. The prisoners were yanked out of their nest, and each one dragged to a wheel and there lashed securely in place, arms outstretched, legs straight out in front of them, and bound to the knee. They could not move, except to turn their heads and look at one another helplessly. The two guards then took up a position close by to enable a tight watch to be kept on their charges. It was plain that neither of the guards relished the duty. Possibly it was too risky, considering what had happened to one of their own that very morning. With both soldiers watching them so closely, Quentin decided that no movements to free themselves could take place. So he ignored the guards and tried to make sense out of the frantic activity taking place around them. The army had chosen a flat lee overlooked by a long, low bluff of poplars and beeches on which to camp. Soldiers were busily dragging fallen trees down from the bluff and pitching them into a great heap in the center of the meadow. Small fires for cooking had already been lit, and the silvery smoke hung in the unmoving evening air. Other soldiers led horses away to a stream somewhere out of sight. Twice Quentin caught a glimpse of the warlord as he rode through the camp, directing the work of his men. He did not so much as glance toward his prisoners. Soon the bustle throughout the camp decreased as the smell of cooking food wafted from the fires. Soldiers grouped around the fires in tight knots, which slowly broke apart into smaller groups. The men sat on the ground with trenchers of wood and dipped their hands into their meal. Quentin decided to try to count the number of soldiers in the party. There were 20 cooking fires scattered across the lee, and by his best estimation, each served 100 or more men. There were more moving about the perimeter, employed in tending horses, gathering firewood, and various other chores. In this body, there were at least 2,000 soldiers, possibly many more. Quentin also noted that the warlord maintained a special bodyguard of 50 or so men who occupied themselves near his circular dome-shaped tent. They ate apart from the others and did none of the menial duties of the rest of the soldiers. As Quentin watched, a man emerged from the tunnel-like opening of the tent and came toward them. Even from a distance, Quentin could see that there was something different about the man. He was vaguely unlike the other soldiers thronging the white meadow. There was something in his bearing, something in his appearance which set him apart. The man, tall and dressed in a loose garment of deepest indigo bedecked with chains of gold, wore an unusual soft flat hat of a kind which Quentin had never seen before. Beneath the hat, a long face protruded which was rimmed by a short bristling beard. The beard was black as pitch, contrasting boldly with the lighter, somewhat sallow complexion of the emissary. He strode with purpose directly to the wagon to stand with hands on hips, glaring down upon the two prisoners.
Hjaldar Folkjok, exhorta asfokat, a warlord Satraba.
The emissary tossed them a hasty look over his shoulder. At once, the guards jumped to their feet and began to untie the prisoners from the wheels of the wagon. The emissary turned and began walking back to the tent. Quentin and Toli were jerked to their feet and pushed forward to follow him. Their guard seemed none too pleased to be about this duty. Quentin wondered what this summons could mean. Toli returned his questioning glance with one of his own as they marched through the camp. Quentin noticed that the eyes of the soldiers they passed followed them with looks of mingled fear and awe. At the warlord's tent, the approach of the emissary and prisoners brought two soldiers to their feet to hold back the entrance flap. The tall man stooped and entered without a word. Quentin and Tolly were pushed forward to follow him. Quentin saw that the inside of the domed tent was like the canopy of the night sky, and just as dark. Tiny golden lamps suspended from golden chains burnt brightly, each one a flaming star in the vault of the heavens. The robed emissary turned to them and held up his hand, indicating that they were to remain where they were. He turned and disappeared behind a richly embroidered hanging curtain.
This is like no commander's pavilion I have ever seen.
Everywhere Quentin looked, the soft glisten of gold and silver met his gaze.
It is a king's palace made to travel.
Tolly, too, registered surprise at the contrast of the fierce warlord and his men and the surroundings of his tent. Just then, the bearded emissary stepped back through the curtain and motioned them forward, drawing aside the curtain. Quentin stepped forward, and as he did so, the warlord's seneschal cuffed him sharply on the neck as an indication that he was to bow in the warlord's presence. Quentin entered the inner sanctum with eyes lowered. He and Tolly stood side by side for some time in silence. No one moved or spoke. Before them and high above, Quentin imagined he could feel the warlord's cool gaze upon them as he pondered their fate.
My lord has decided that you may sit in his presence. He wishes you to eat with him, but you are not to speak unless he asks you a question, and then you are to answer without hesitation. If either of you do not answer at once, he will know that you are contemplating a lie and will have your tongue cut out that your friend may eat it. And remember not to follow your example. Sit!
They seated themselves, with some difficulty in Quentin's case.
You may raise your eyes.
Quentin and Tolly did as instructed.
Look upon the immortal Gerd, commander of the Ningal, warlord of Nin the Destroyer.
Quentin was not prepared for the sight which met his eyes.